This is Mark Strassman, reporter with the Etopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to Dr. Dominic Iacuzio, who's the medical director for Roche Pharmaceuticals, headquartered in Nutley, New Jersey. Welcome to Etopia Media Medical News Network.
Good afternoon.
We're here to talk about Tamiflu. Tamiflu is a brand name for a drug which has a more difficult to pronounce a generic name. What is that drug that Tamiflu is a brand name of?
It's oseltamivir.
Okay, and that's obviously where it gets that's where the Tamiflu name comes from.
Right.
Before we talk about how it works, could you distinguish between the approach taken by antibiotics, vaccinations, and antivirals in fighting virus infections?
Sure. We could start off with antibiotics. Antibiotics are against bacteria.
Right.
Antibiotics will not work against influenza viruses. A virus is a different animal, you might say, or
right.
Infectious agent.
Right.
It's not a bacteria. It actually infects a cell, takes over that cell's genetic machinery to make new virions, new virus particles.
Right.
The targets for inhibiting that whole process of a virus infection is targeted by antiviral drugs.
Okay.
Antibiotics would only affect a bacterial with its own unique, replication system or a method of respiration or whatever it takes for its energy.
So it doesn't matter how many and how often you take antibiotics, they're not going to stop the flu.
They're not going to stop a viral infection, and the flu, the real flu, is caused by a virus.
Okay, and in fact, they can kill off the weaker members of the bacteria family and leave the field open for the more powerful ones and the mutated ones.
Exactly, resistance and all that.
Okay, so antibiotic resistance is a very important factor in treating infectious diseases these days.
Sure, exactly, and it's a major concern by clinicians because they want to utilize, or I should say, restrict the use of antibiotics so you don't have or facilitate the resistance, emergence of new resistance strains.
Right. We're not going to talk about it at all here, but I just wanted to give it a plug. C. difficile, which has become more virulent and is spreading in Canada in particular and a little in the UK, is pretty much the direct result of the powerful antibiotics being given to people for pneumonia and other diseases like that, and then knocking out the flora intestinally and
right.
leaving the field open for the C. difficile and so on. How does vaccination work?
Works by exposing an individual to specific proteins or substances that make up the virus or on the surface of the virus protein.
Right.
So that a person now's immune system makes antibodies to those specific proteens.
Right,
which
so
are unique
right.
to the virus.
So essentially, the body's immune system is mobilized against what it thinks is a threat of a particular virulent strain.
Well, it's not so much thinks that it is. It's just that it actually produces antibodies which can react
to the
assault, you might say, of a new virus infection.
Right, but these elements that are used in the vaccination are themselves not harmful.
No, they're usually proteins or mimics of the protein, the structure
right.
That's unique to the virus.
Right,
and because of that, those antibodies are specific for that virus or that type of virus.
Right. In fact, the agents in the vaccination have the face to the immune system of a more dangerous
exactly.
virus, but they don't have the deleterious parts of it. And so
right.
when the deleterious and face ones come in, the immune system is ready to go against it.
Exactly. And right. and because they're so specific,
right.
the flu virus, its unique characteristic is to mutate or to change from season to season or during the entire season.
Right.
That you have, that's why sometimes vaccines against a specific strain are not protective against even related strains.
Exactly.
Or especially unrelated strains.
Right. So in fact, it takes a concerted effort of the biomedical community to put together a vaccine against any newly arising viral agent.
Exactly. When I used to work in the public health service, I used to participate in those, you know, discussions or meetings that they would hold in the U.S. at least every January and February to look at that data and to decide, you know, from the surveillance data and from the laboratory data, which strains are circulating, which strains are cross-reactive, which strains the manufacturers have experience with making, so decisions are made about choosing or selecting the strains that would go in the next year's vaccine. So it's a real process.
Okay, and now because the vaccines need to be targeted against a specific set of proteins on the surface of the virus, then if a virus hasn't been around for a while, no one has immunity to it, and that's the underlying reason why pandemics can arise.
Yes, that's true. Well, it's right. That's an explanation of why even new virus strains, which drift from year to year, survive.
Right.
But the definition for a pandemic is not only that exactly, but the pandemic really means a whole new virus subtype where the entire population is completely unexposed. They have no history of this new subtype.
Right. In other words, everyone's been, each person has a particular profile of what they're protected against, either by their own natural immunity or by induced immunity from vaccines.
Exactly.
But if you look at the whole world population and see what they're protected against, if a new strain comes up,
right,
that's out of nature, that's been mutated into a new form, no one has ever been exposed to it naturally, and no one's ever been vaccinated,
right,
against it artificially, and therefore no,
right,
one has any protection against it.
Exactly. But with flu, we actually know of 15 subtypes,
right,
that have been identified by virologists and epidemiologists and veterinarians.
Right.
That there are 15 subtypes, of which only 3 have ever circulated into humans, of type A viruses, and 2 are currently circulating, the type A H1N1 and the type A H3N2. Back in 57 to 68, there was another subtype, H2N2, which hasn't circulated since, you know, over 30 years now, 32 years.
So in fact, there's a reservoir of not yet circulated viruses.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the major concern right now has been the appearance, I should say, of and spread of the H5, H7, and H9 avian strains,
right,
which is a concern.
Okay. There are two directions I want to go, and I can't go both places,
sure,
at once, but let's then talk about antivirals and how they differ from vaccinations as an approach and how they might,
right,
solve the problem that we've just delineated.
Sure. Well, there are two classes of antivirals. The older class, the amantadines, consist of amantadine and rimantadine, and they're targeted against what they call an M2 protein or an ion pore channel. During the early phase of infection, the virus gets engulfed by the cell.
Right.
It's in what they call a cell vacuole, and the pH is dropped within this, and that pore that goes into the virus for the uncoating of that virus, so all the genetic material can be released and then go through its replication phase.
Right.
The essential part for that to happen is this ion pore has to be open, and so the hydrogen ions flow through.
Right.
Amantadine and rimantadine physically block that, and they,
right,
so it's more of a structural. But the change of that ion pore, I mean, the structure of that can change by a single amino acid change, and then those antiviral drugs are no longer effective.
Right, so
the virus becomes resistant.
Right, so they're powerful but limited in their
exactly,
in their
and
effect.
There is a newer class of antiviral drugs called the neuraminidase inhibitors,
right,
which are targeted against a different protein. It's actually a surface enzyme, and its function is at the later stages of infection, after the virus goes through its replication phase and now has infected the cells, and new virus particles are now attached to the outside of the cell, about ready to release and cause the further spread of the infection.
Right.
There's an enzyme called neuraminidase, which cleaves the the bond between the new budding virus particle and the surface of that cell, the receptors on that cell, sialic acid receptors.
They call right.
And this enzyme basically frees the virus, almost as if it was cutting the bonds, you might say, from like a virus attaching itself to the cell like Velcro,
right.
you might say. And so the neuraminidase cleaves those bonds, and now the virus is able to spread to other tissues, other cells, and continue the infection process, or actually it accelerates.
Okay, now then how does oseltamivir interfere with that?
Okay, this is a class of drugs that was designed with, I'd say, like 21st century technology.
Right.
They crystallize the surface, that protein, the
right.
enzyme.
Right.
They mapped it out by molecular modeling, the actual site of where the active site of the enzyme, and designed a molecule that would fit directly by that structure perfectly into this pocket. And now they created this, they synthesized the compound, and that would fit perfectly into this enzyme. So it would bind specifically to this enzyme, and it has more than one parts of attachment.
Right.
So if there is one single amino acid change, in most cases, it has no effect unless it's directly in the pocket of that enzyme.
So to use a non-technical term, it gloms on to the enzyme.
Excuse me?
It gloms onto it.
It actually gets in there, almost
right.
like, I would say, intercalates. It actually binds into the pocket of that enzyme and prevents that enzyme from functioning.
And for how long? Indefinitely?
Well, the binding is there. When you take the drug and it's at a high enough concentration, it stays there. It's specific for that enzyme, and it stays there. So it basically inhibits that enzyme from its function.
Okay, and then how does that interfere with the more general process by which the virus spreads within the body?
Well, then just think of the virus now after it infects the cell. It sticks to the cell just like Velcro.
Right.
And it's not going anywhere. And
right.
then now a person's basic immune system is able to gobble up this foreign particle and dispose of it.
Does it gobble up the cell or just the foreign particle?
It would probably, gobble up the infected. By that time, that cell has been compromised. It's done with because it's already been infected by the virus particle.
And it essentially gives off the biochemical signals to tell the immune system you might as well eat this up and destroy.
Yeah,
and
then you have inflammatory response and all those other mechanisms
right.
that kick in to help clean up the infection.
Okay. So, when was this work done, and when did Tamiflu come on the market?
I believe, the drug was, I think, patented, I'd say maybe a half a dozen years ago or a little bit more. No, probably a little bit longer than that.
Right. Late 90s.
Yeah, late 90s. There was a drug that was patented, I think, just a couple of years before that, Zanamivir. It was quickly, put into clinical studies, and it probably had one of the fastest paces through FDA review, so it's been on the market now for about, I think, since 99.
Okay, so 99. So now there are essentially two ways it can be given. One is after an infection has been begun, or prophylactically. Talk about the timing and the. A little bit about the dosages and how it's used for people who've been infected.
Well, for people who have been infected, the infection process for influenza is an acute viral infection.
Right.
When people get initially infected, it probably takes anywhere from 1 to 3 days before probably less than that, 24 hours about, before a person starts to feel the symptoms of flu.
What's happening at the cellular level during that period?
Well, what's happening is the virus infects a cell, and it goes through this rapid replication phase of infecting a cell, reproducing itself, spreading to new cells and continuing, accelerating this process.
And how does the infection of the cell make you, quote, sick? How does that make you feel bad and have symptoms?
When you're going through this accelerated phase of infection and release of cells, and as I'm saying, this virus replicates at a fast rate. So within a short period of time, your body is being exposed to thousands of virus particles, if not millions of particles.
Okay, before we talk about what the particles do, the rate of internal infection is essentially an exponential one, is it?
It is. It's exponential, and your body now is responding to that with immune mechanisms. And a lot of these are interleukins, all these immune modulators, and it is actually the rise in these inflammatory mediators or immune modulators, which are telling the body, start triggering your white blood cells and, you know, increase antibody production. There's all these things that are going on, dilation of blood vessels and, you know, increasing blood flow.
So, in fact,
that's what makes a person all of a sudden feel like I've been hit by a train.
And in fact, you're not feeling bad because of the direct impact of the presence of the virus. It's because the body reacts to that to essentially ring all of the alarm bells to bring in the defense mechanisms, and it's the ringing of the alarm bells that makes you feel bad.
It's the rise, and in fact, there have been studies that have shown that there are all these cytokines and lymphokines, the rise, the titer of these, immune modulators are linked to a person feeling very sick.
Okay, so as that process begins, the person takes the Tamiflu. How is it administered? Pills, injections, liquids?
Tamiflu comes in a capsule form.
Okay, how 75 milligrams?
It's 75 milligrams, and for treatment, the approved dosage is two capsules, one capsule twice a day for 5 days. It comes in a 10-pack pack of 10 capsules.
Okay, and that's essentially to apply the chemical at a steady level.
At a steady state. Exactly.
Okay, and so it comes in and does what we just talked about a few minutes ago.
Right.
To interfere with the process, and does it tend to stop the spread of the virus in its tracks, or slow it down, or what?
It pretty much almost stops it in its tracks. I mean, there's no guarantee from what we see of laboratory data and from the and from some experimental infection. Within a short period of time, you see a decrease in the viral load or the titer.
Right.
There are graphs showing the decrease shortly after dosing.
And so, in fact, because the Tamiflu shuts down the replication process, the immune system, the alarms that we talked about that are raised that make you feel sick in order to mobilize the immune system don't take place.
Right. Well, they take place at a lower level. They start to diminish. And that probably explains why we hear anecdotal reports from some patients who actually report that they started to feel better soon after they start taking the drug.
We can't exclude a placebo effect there either.
No, exactly. You can't. And based on our clinical study data that's accumulated, you know, we see a 1.3-day or 30% reduction. So we could talk about that because that's what's in our approval and in our package.
Right.
But we do hear anecdotal information from physicians and patients saying that they soon after they started feeling taking the drug, they noticed a difference.
So in fact, there's a rising curve, maybe a bell-shaped curve even of the symptoms, and that's essentially depressed by this. It would be right to generalize and say that what we talked about for the single cell then takes place in the whole system. That the compromised cells that have the inactivated virus on them then are destroyed by the immune system and go away that way.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, those that are, you know, the cells that are already infected and that the virus particles are still attached to them will be cleaned up by, you know, one's healthy immune system.
Right. Okay. Now, that's in the case where people take this after they've been infected. What's the optimal time to take it in the cycle?
The optimal, because of our, you know, we're... targeting an acute viral respiratory disease, within the first 48 hours, we see the best results.
In other words, before it gets so, before it spreads far enough that it's, that this becomes less effective, that the Tamiflu becomes less effective,
right.
it just can't do that much interfering anymore.
Exactly.
Because it's been spread so far.
Because it's an acute infection, meaning it doesn't go on for weeks.
Right.
That soon after, you know, the first 3 to 4 days, I mean, you probably only have another day or two of the infection process.
Right.
And so it would start to diminish normally.
Okay. That's after infection. There's another modality, which would be prophylactically or preventively, preemptively. What's the mechanism that operates in that case?
Right. Well, a scenario would be, for example, if someone, you know, you had a child or a relative who was sick and you were exposed, which we would call a recent or post-exposure prophylaxis, or seasonal. You just wanted to take flu's in your neighborhood or area, and you wanted to start taking it. You would start taking the drug once a day, so only one capsule a day for prophylaxis.
Okay.
And as long as you take the drug, we've had studies that individuals took it for only 7 days.
Right.
And like I said, a post-exposure where an individual, they knew that they were exposed from somebody in their house being diagnosed with flu.
Right.
To a nursing home study where they actually were dosed for about 6 weeks, you know, during what they called a local outbreak of flu in a nursing home
right.
or in a locale. And either study has shown that when individuals were on Tamiflu and flu was circulating, there was a reduction in illness. Pool data, I believe in one of the studies, was 89% to 92%.
That's a pretty good level
yeah.
of anything. Does Tamiflu have any side effects that would mitigate, that would militate against prophylactic use, widespread prophylactic use?
In all the studies, it appears that in all the studies, the side effects appear to be similar for the short duration of 7 days and for the 6 weeks. And it was mainly mild nausea and vomiting, and just a little bit above the small percentage points above the placebo.
Okay. So this would all right. This works against what viruses does Tamiflu have the effect that we've been talking about?
Right. The Tamiflu, because it's part of the neuraminidase class of antivirals, is effective against types A and B.
Okay.
As opposed to the older antivirals, which are only type A.
What's the difference between type A and type B?
Well, type A viruses are a type of virus which infect humans
right.
and are the class that could also cause a pandemic.
Right.
Type B are another class of influenza viruses which are only circulate in humans, and they do not appear, they have a little bit different structure. They don't have the M2 protein, for example.
So,
and that's why the older antiviral drugs, amantadine and rimantadine, are not effective against them.
So influenza B only exists in humans, but influenza A exists in humans and animals.
And animals.
Okay. Speaking of animals now, avian, I want to talk a little bit about avian influenza, where it comes from, how it works, and so on. It's essentially resident in wild bird populations, ducks and so on.
Migrating birds, yes, and in waterfowl particularly.
Does it harm them, or are they just carriers?
No, they are carriers.
So they don't die from it.
And they don't die, and occasionally the virus might mutate and jump to another species or infect another, other animals or other migratory bird or other birds.
Right. The way I understand that the chain goes is that essentially the wild birds, the fowl, the ducks,
right.
May hang out with some domestic ducks in Asia
right.
where there's a lot of domestic ducks.
Sure.
And they essentially spread it to them.
Right.
And then the ducks hang out with the pigs. And the pigs are able to harbor both avian flu strain and human flu strain, and then the human and avian viruses hang out together inside the pigs, and then the farmer comes to feed the pigs or whatever, or slaughter them, and they get exposed, and then if it mutates in a human so that it can be carried from a human to a human, then we're in trouble.
Yes, but one thing about that some people don't recognize sometimes is that the virus, as it when it circulates in the waterfowl, the wild duck population, it's not just a respiratory virus. It's actually excreted in the feces
of the birds.
Of the birds. So that's the mechanism that I think epidemiologists believe that the ducks could, you know, fly over a pond.
Oh,
you know,
I see. Right.
Drop in there for a little bit. Drop some of the feces off in the water,
right,
and travel on. And now this water could be infected with influenza viruses, or dried feces could aerosolize,
right,
as the pigs or ducks or chickens, you know, walk through the you know, the whatever on a farm.
Right. And, yes. Go ahead.
And it could be aerosolized, and so it's not just a, you know, it doesn't take close contact.
Right.
It could be spread, you know, in a very short time.
This sounds like a very effective means. If you've got these birds migrating and they fly over, I mean, it's like bombing.
It can be considered like that, or look like.
And so maybe we need more duck hunters, or is that would that be ineffective as an approach?
There are. That reminds me of a few lines in the movie The Birds. I guess how many billions of birds out there?
Right.
I don't think they're
that's not a viable strategy.
It's not exactly.
Okay,
that's not going to work.
And in fact, when it's gone from the wild fowl to the domestic fowl in Asia, this has meant that the strategy has been to kill millions of domestic fowl, hasn't it?
Right, exactly.
All right.
But,
and how is that?
What's happening is now that it's been identified in the wild bird population,
right,
that strategy is, you know, obviously not going to work.
Okay, so what strategy on a sort of larger level, not the molecular, but the sort of public health level, is being followed, and how does Tamiflu fit into that strategy?
Well, the Public Health Service has had a series of meetings, not only in the U.S., but there have been international meetings held on pandemic planning. And
who's in charge of all this globally?
Well, on the U.S. side, it's the U.S. Department of Health,
right?
We've been talking with officials within the Public Health Service, the National Vaccine Program Office, and others,
And internationally
affiliated with the CDC,
and
other agencies within the public health system.
And how's that coordinated on a global level?
And WHO is also very much involved.
World Health Organization.
World Health.
Part of the UN.
Yes. And also on Canada side, they actually held a G8 meeting this past spring with, representatives from the G8 countries, a G7 plus, I believe it was Mexico, I believe. And Health Canada was the health agency in Canada that hosted, you know, the meeting. And there are strategies, you know, going in parallel of trying to prepare experimental vaccines,
right,
with these H5 and H7 and H9 subtypes.
Chiron and Aventis have contracts to do that, I think.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they are also talking with antiviral drug manufacturers to stockpile. And so Roche has been involved both on the global level from our headquarters in Basel,
right,
and from the U.S. affiliate here in Nutley, New Jersey.
Okay, now, the recent, I don't want to call it a debacle yet, but the crisis with domestic flu vaccine that was precipitated when Chiron's plant in Liverpool was decertified by the British Health Authority because of sanitation questions,
right,
throwing the whole situation here in the U.S. into disarray, what does that say about the readiness of the global public health structures, or maybe only particularly about U.S. policy about protecting against these diseases as it applies to avian flu? In other words, is this a warning sign, a reminder of things that haven't been done yet, or exactly what?
Well, I think it just points to the, when we depend on either one or just a limited number of suppliers, things happen. And in the case of influenza virus, it has to be manufactured and reformulated every year. It's a tremendous undertaking.
And it takes a long time.
And it takes a while. And you produce a product that only has 1 year shelf life.
And in fact, or less, if the dominant strain becomes a different one, if it mutates and becomes a different strain, and you've got a whole stockpile of vaccine against the old one,
right,
it's worthless.
Right. I really think it's just a very difficult effort and strategy just to make vaccines every year and to produce them and to have them ready for the variable threat from year to year with the strains mutating and drifting. It is like trying to hit a moving target. So
okay.
it's a real challenge.
So this is where the antivirals can really shine, isn't it?
Yes.
What's the situation in terms of that stockpiling? How piled up is the stock now, and what do you estimate would be an appropriate level globally, domestically in the U.S. to have on hand? What is of Tamiflu or Tamiflu-like agents, and what is its shelf life once it's
well,
been
you're
produced?
Getting into a lot of questions that I think the public health agency really needs to make the decisions on. I believe as now being part of Roche, I could only talk to what the company is doing.
Right.
We had up until last year only one manufacturing site in Basel, Switzerland.
Right.
And in response to concerns about pandemic planning and discussions we had with not only with the U.S. government, but with Roche Global having discussions with other governments throughout the world,
right.
other countries, to stockpile antiviral drugs, we took it upon ourselves in the U.S. to initiate an entire U.S. production line in addition to the one which is ongoing and approved currently for the licensed product in Basel. So,
is that up and running? Where is it?
The one that we have in Basel, Switzerland, has been running since the product was launched or before.
Right.
But now in the U.S. we are initiating a entire U.S. supply chain, and it starts in our affiliates, or I should say our sites that we have for production in Colorado and South Carolina, and even involving Nutley, New Jersey.
Say just a little bit about the production process, what the raw materials are. I mean, don't give away the proprietary points,
no.
What essentially goes into making Tamiflu and
well, there's
and
a starting material, which is an extract. It's a proprietary, I believe, extract that's made. And there are a few suppliers that Roche purchased the starting material.
Right.
And then from there are several production steps, which are highly complex and require specialized equipment.
Right. And a big capital investment, I imagine.
Yes, and in fact, one of them actually, Roche, I believe, actually employs the production facility of a third-party manufacturer.
Okay.
Because it involves the step of azide chemistry, which is very technical, because it's nitrogen chemistry, it could be explosive.
Right.
And so it needs to have special equipment,
right.
Containment.
And rather than build that yourself, you've essentially outsourced that step in the process.
And also, too, to employ a manufacturing facility that has the workers who are trained in
right.
that type to handle that type of production process.
Okay. Now
and then there's a specialized step of the granulation, which is kind of unique. And I think Roche has designed specialized equipment because of the alcohol step that's involved. And they normally, in the old way, would be to evacuate this into the atmosphere. And because
right.
of EPA regulations, you have to reclaim this under vacuum technology. And so it requires specialized equipment to get that granulation step completed.
Okay, now with just a little bit we've talked about here, this is obviously a very complex procedure.
Exactly.
It must take a certain length of time to do all this.
It, It takes an average of 6 to 8 months, depending on how things are scheduled. And like I said, because since there are multiple steps, if you once you complete one step, how are you able to start up the other step
right.
the process? And especially if it's shipping to a different site to start that process.
Right.
So logistics, timing, starting materials, all that is essential.
In fact, not only are these among the most complicated substances ever produced by mankind, but they involve, obviously, then some of the most complicated production procedures ever devised either.
Exactly.
How rapidly could they be, given what we've just discussed, how rapidly can they be ramped up? Can you just clone the factories and do more, or that you have to train more people, you have to build the, you have to get the raw materials? In other words, how fast could this be ramped up?
Well, I think from what I'm hearing from those who are more involved with the production operations, once we have that new facility up and running and it's approved by the FDA as being, producing, FDA certified material.
Right.
That it can be, that particular site can be geared up.
Right.
To produce, probably an order of magnitude more material
right.
than what we've done in the past.
Okay. Now we've been talking essentially about a defense against a threat, which is not malintentioned. Nature is not out, or maybe it is out to get us. We haven't been talking about bioterrorism.
No.
Which is essentially a parallel, which is a concentration, a synthesis of that process, or a copying of that process by humans with bad intent.
Exactly.
Where does Tamiflu, what are the prospects or the scenarios according to which Tamiflu could be mobilized against bioterrorist threats of biochemically identical or similar to what we've been talking about, but generated by malevolent humans instead of the natural processes of the world?
Well, hopefully the virus, either that would be produced either by someone with malintent or with in the wild,
right.
would still have the neuraminidase that would be intact, and with that, Tamiflu could be used, if it was a naturally occurring new pandemic strain or one that was created in a laboratory.
Cool.
So
right.
that either or. The stockpiling of antiviral drugs like Tamiflu should be effective.
Okay. Equally against a bioterrorist as a
right.
natural threat. What about cost? Is this, we've talked about how it's a lengthy process, a complex process. Is it also an expensive process?
Well, it is, but during the in negotiations with government officials, the company has discuss the whole idea of for stockpiling the drug that there would be reduced cost, you might say.
They can buy in bulk.
Yeah, buy in bulk, you might say, exactly.
I don't know if you answered this question about the shelf life. Once it's produced, is it? We're not talking about how long it works in people, but how long it can stay in the warehouse.
Exactly.
How long would it have to be replaced after 6 months or 2 years or whatever with newly produced material, or is it good for a pretty long time?
Well, right now we have recently, this past year, been extended our shelf life to 5 years.
Okay.
And based on what the chemists are telling us, because it's stable,
right.
so stable at 5 years, they're predicting that it's stable for another, 2 to 3 to maybe 5 more years.
Okay, so it could. All right, so.
It's unsure of how long it would be. In fact, I think the concern there would be if it was in the capsule stage that the capsule would become too brittle.
Right.
At that point, but right now the active ingredient, which is in the bulk stage,
right.
The chemists are predicting that it's very stable.
So in fact, it could be produced in the bulk form and sit around and then be encapsulated
and that's
at the
one
right
of
time.
That's one of the thoughts is to store it in a bulk
right.
In a bulk step. But there are other issues with that because then if you needed to turn that immediately to the granulation phase,
right.
then you would be limited with the amount of production facilities
exactly.
to be able to do that.
So
but the global team has actually came up with a process, I should say a plan to store it in the bulk phase before the granulation.
Right.
And then to store it as a bulk that could be used as a bulk.
How do you mean? How would it be used as a bulk? If it's used in the bulk stage, essentially it's sitting as a powder in barrels, or
yes, that would be in large drums.
And right, and then it has to be go through other machines to become granulated before it can go into the capsules.
That would be one way to do that, or it could be dispensed as a light fluffy powder in that bulk phase.
Right,
and then made into a solution that during a pandemic.
Right.
Extreme case like that possibly could be distributed to the public.
Can it be pre-granulated and sit around as in the granulated form, ready to be put into capsules, or by then?
The thought being that once you go to the granulation phase, that probably would compromise some of the stability that is
right.
in the bulk.
And if once it's granulated, you want to encapsulate it right away.
Sure.
But then the limiting factor becomes the capsules get worn out after.
So that's okay. Sort of a dilemma, but it really depends on the governments that we're talking to. Some countries are stockpiling the bulk.
Right.
Some are stockpiling or planning to stockpile just the capsules.
Okay.
And some are considering a combination of both.
All right. Speaking of countries, are there problems? Has enough been learned from AIDS and other occurrences of disease that issues about disproportionate use of this in the developed countries, less developed countries, has that been worked out, or are there problems ahead in that area?
I really can't comment on the stockpiling in all different countries. I think that would be a question more for the global team, since I think my realm is really strictly the medical director here at Roche Labs.
Right. So issues about whether certain parts of the globe are going to be protected against a pandemic and certain parts aren't.
Right. I think that's something that has been discussed at WHO meetings.
And presumably someone's on that. They're working on that issue now.
Yes.
Okay. What about the possibility of mutation by the viruses against this strategy, or is it impossible for them to do that and maintain their integrity as what they do, of what they are? Is there a natural strategy that could react against this strategy that would render it useless?
I'm missing the point. You mean as far as the antiviral drug itself?
Right. Is there some way that nature could protect itself against this effort to interfere with it?
Oh, I see what you say.
Right.
Well, there have been some viral isolates that are resistant to oseltamivir or the neuraminidase inhibitors.
Right.
We've seen this in the lab, and there's been a report recently in The Lancet.
How do they do that?
They actually they intensely did surveillance or cloning of the isolates
right.
from young children who were infected with flu
right.
in a hospital setting. And they collected those viral isolates and then amplified them and looked for the strains, you might say, the isolates that were resistant by a screening mechanism
right.
to oseltamivir.
Right.
They did see a higher rate of resistant strains or virus isolates than they had seen in any previous study. But on the flip side, the question is, what was the viability of these virus strains? Were they strictly identified because they were amplified to such a higher titer than had ever been attempted
right.
in any previous study? And are these virus isolates infective at all?
Okay.
So
in other words, they may be resistant, but they might not be very infective.
Exactly.
The danger, of course, is that, and this is kind of what's happening with C. difficile, is that the strains that are both more virulent and more resistant are developing against the antibiotics that are creating their environment.
Right.
So I guess my question is, has it been determined yet by what mechanism these more resistant strains are doing their resisting?
Well,
how are they interfering with the process the Tamiflu normally implements?
Well, they're just not binding to the, they're just not, the drug is not binding to the active site of the enzyme. And so what's happening with that is that the virus now has a defective, you might say, neuraminidase, an enzyme.
Right.
And the enzyme is needed, like I said, in order for it to free the cell.
Right.
To free the new virus particles from the cell. So, based on what I have seen in talking to other virologists, except for one or two virus isolates that have been identified, most of them appear to be growth impaired, basically.
Okay. In other words, they can resist it, but it doesn't do them that much good in the back.
Exactly. So we really haven't seen that combination like you've,
right.
like you're referring to for the antibiotics.
So, yeah, I guess what I want to understand is whether or not there's a theoretical path that the viruses could take to defend themselves against Tamiflu.
The one that I think some virologists were pointing to was if there was a hemagglutinin and that also mutated.
Right.
So now you would not only have a change in the surface neuraminidase protein,
right.
but now the hemagglutinin would not be able to react as well or bind as well.
Right.
And so with that, you would, but then on the flip side,
right.
if the hemagglutinin is not working as efficiently, then it might not attach to the cell or infect the cell as well.
Right.
So it's sort of a
not a chicken and egg exactly.
Exactly. So we've seen the virologists have theorized this, but they really haven't seen this.
Happen. Okay. So in fact, the further research, the next generation. The question I'm trying to get to here is. Is this a stable and perfected strategy at the molecular level to fight the virus? And if it isn't, what work are you doing to anticipate the next evolutionary response?
Sure.
That's essentially what we've been talking about. That's where your next generation research is going into, the points we've just been talking about?
Yes, I think that would be the future, but to be quite honest with you, I'm not aware of any effort right now by this company
right.
or by other individuals. I know that there have been other products that were in early phase development,
right?
But I've also learned that some of them, and there are many, if not all of them, have fallen by the wayside because they did not pan out so far.
So you're relatively confident that you've essentially gotten the jump on the process right now, and that
right.
this is a system that's likely to work for at least for the foreseeable future.
For the foreseeable future, exactly.
Okay.
And I think until that time where I think virologists are able to identify another target
right.
or a different strategy, I think the company is thinking that. That this product is the way to go.
Okay. How long is the do the patents run on Tamiflu for?
Well, Tamiflu is one of the fastest drugs from development through licensing.
Right.
And I believe the patent goes through 2015.
Okay. So there won't be any generic version of this for
right.
another 11 years at least.
Yes.
Okay. One last question, which may be a little bit outside of your bailiwick, but might not be. As a reporter on this front, I've been covering problems that Merck has been having with Vioxx, Pfizer with Paxil and Neurontin, Chiron with its virus decertification. Roche hasn't been in any of that news. Why not? What distinguishes Roche from these companies that have been having these kind of regulatory and with recall problems and so on?
I really can't comment on other problems with other products
right.
with other companies. I think the only thing that I could say is that I think Roche has cooperated fully with public health officials on the information that we've generated in clinical studies about this product. We do participate in what they call a surveillance network to look at resistant viruses and people who are treated with oseltamivir, and the virus isolates are collected and tested at public health laboratories and at World Health Organization or CDC and other collaborators. So I think the company has been very responsible and working with you know, government officials and experts in the field to show that the that the drug is working effectively and that they're monitoring resistance. And I think that's all we could do right now.
Okay, let's wrap up by sort of coming back a little bit to the avian flu threat, what Roche is doing, what the public health authorities are doing, what the public ought to be doing, what governments are doing. How likely do you think it is that an avian flu pandemic is likely to arise?
Well, I, to quote others who are far more senior in this area than I am, they use the phrase, and it's been quoted, that the sort of the pandemic clock has been ticking. It's just that we don't know what time it is.
Right.
And I think that's to say that based on the information that we're hearing about at an increasingly frequent rate,
right,
of issues regarding this virus, its ability to spread from one species to another, ability to infect humans occasionally. I think most virologists are wondering, we've been dodging the bullet, and at what time in the future? And some feel that it could be within a few years or several years.
And is it something that stringent public health measures could defeat, or is it inevitably going to spread?
I don't see how we can interrupt something that's already in the wild bird population.
Okay,
I really don't.
And as we said much earlier on here, the strategy of vaccinating against this, even apart from the Senate, the issues that arose in the Chiron case, against a mutating virus is not really strategically that likely to be successful, is it?
No, especially if the virus continually mutates.
Right.
I mean, unless you have stockpiled or prepared vaccines against each of the subtypes and each of the possible variants,
that would rapidly become a nightmare of logistics.
I think an incredible task.
Right. On the other hand, the antiviral strategy. To tell us how that would be a solid line of defense.
Exactly. At least until a vaccine target or candidate,
right,
has been properly identified and then manufactured in large quantities.
And in fact, the reason this all is because the likelihood of the virus family mutating at the level that you're attacking it is a lot less likely than it is has already been demonstrated that it can mutate at the levels that the vaccines go after.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think we've taken it up and down the ladder as much as we can. I want to thank you very much for talking to us. Hopefully we can check in a little later and see how this is all going.
Great.
If people who are concerned about this, is there anything they can do by talking to has the federal government been doing everything that you as a medical person think it should
yes.
be?
Yes, I think so. I'm not speaking from a bias of working previously with the federal government, but
right.
I know a lot of the individuals who spent a lot of their time working at the CDC, at the NIH, at the FDA, Public Health Service, and believe me, they are doing I'm sure they feel all that they can to increase awareness and to do what I think we all need to do is plan wisely for what might be and what the virologists and epidemiologists are telling us is an eventual threat that may happen sooner than we would all like.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we were able to talk to you and have you explain this to our listeners. Thanks again very much.
All right. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.